Welcome to the Colorado Review podcast, featuring prose and poetry from recent and archived issues of the journal. I'm Megan Pipe, and this month I'm joined by editorial assistant Danny Schoening to read and chat about poetry selections from the fall-winter 2017 issue. Stay tuned. All right. Happy December, podcast listeners. Welcome to the last episode of 2017. Here today with me is editorial assistant and poet Danny Schoening, who is going to give us a little preview into the poetry of our beautiful, luminous fall winter 2017 issue. Thanks for joining us, Danny.
Thanks for having me. Luminous is right.
I know. The cover, the poetry, the fiction and nonfiction, everything about it, I think. So, Danny, we are in the last days of the fall semester here at Colorado State, which means that you are wrapping up your first semester as a CLP intern. How's the experience been so far?
It's been fantastic. I think coming in, I was expecting to be exposed to a lot of good writing, and I was excited to broaden the scope of poets that I know, but I wasn't expecting to get the breadth of skills that I have while I was here.
That's great. What have you gotten to work on this semester?
I was able to copy edit, to proofread, and to spend an inordinate amount of time on the queue. So a lot of reading stellar poets. There were, an incredible volume of submissions. I think one of the most valuable things I've gotten from my time here is to have insight into the other side of the process that I've, for a good while, been not privy to, but still trying to contribute to.
Yeah.
And so it's been really fantastic being able to read and edit poetry. In specific.
Well, happy that you're here and specifically in the recording studio today.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's dive right into the poetry. Can you tell us the first poem that you want to read for us and maybe a little bit about why you chose it?
Absolutely. So the first poem that I've chosen is by Adonis. He has two poems in this issue of Colorado Review. And he's a fantastic Syrian poet whose work has been really foundational for modern Arabic poetry's movements away from inherited forms into free verse. He's translated by Khalid Matoua, who himself is a pivotal figure in poetry generally, but certainly in Arabic translation. And so one of his two poems is entitled Tempted by Nothing, and the other, which I'm going to read, is Tempted by Everything. The former is a stunning work of praise, while the latter works as this lamenting counterpoint that brings Al-Quds, or Jerusalem, from the spiritual to the worldly and then back again. It's really stunning. So I'll start with number 8, Tempted by Everything, by Adonis, from Concerto Al-Quds, translated from the Arabic by Khalid Matoua. A song. It's true. The firmament in Al-Quds resembles a cage, the whole universe in a mere 1,000 square meters. Piles of papers stand at each crossroad, shaped like books. Ink spills out of them at the speed of 20 centuries for each letter, 30 centuries a comma, and countless centuries a period. Oh, what a pile Solomon's hoopoe is pecking through, line by line. Have the holy books fallen into the abyss? The rock of Al-Quds is a stone from paradise. Greek Orthodox, Copts, Assyrians, Chaldeans, Roman Catholics, Armenians, Abyssinians, Kurds, Turks, Circassians, Moroccans, refugees, farmers, civilians, city folk, Jews, Arabs, humidity, heat, falafel, frankincense, settler colonization, occupation, doves, pigeons, cars, Pepsi-Cola, minarets, bells, 1 square kilometer, no more. The gate of Al-Quds is the land of summoning and resurrection. Whoever prepares for the pilgrimage from the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem to the Masjid al-Haram in Mecca, God will forgive his past and future sins, and paradise is guaranteed him. The house bids its memory farewell, and the dust around it lifts its sleeves in wind that ruffles the day's heads with violence, with locusts that devour the shoots of time. Women had planted their wombs into dream earth and commissioned God with the task of reaping. Some of them die at nightfall and are reborn at dawn. Some write a lover's sighs with the patience of the sages. Some wear yokes, mistaking them for fur collars. No sound except what issues from hurricanes banging against metal, and light bouncing in confusion from one metal to another. Ghosts assemble and dissemble under the armpits of space. The Mediterranean sits up in on its atomic throne, or on the very throne of God. Veined hands wrestle over the blubber of time. The body of desire stands on a metal platform. Its spirit lies sprawled on the asphalt. And you, dear water, when will you separate yourself from clay? Night, scatter your stars over Al-Quds. The prophets of insomnia sleep among her severed limbs. At her feet, mud stands, then breaks apart into deserts and ravines. What will happen to those divine tablets that descended to Al-Quds, Jerusalem? What will happen to the devils and their armies, to the angels and their gods? What will happen to the earth and her children? Does anyone know Al-Quds except her stars? I think the thing that's most viscerally striking first from this piece is its central refrain, the stars over Al-Quds that we begin with and then return to. I think the poem grappling with the city's changes over time, meaning that's gained and lost, land that's contested, that's changing hands, all punctuated and then even restrained by the cage of stars from that opening, this kind of permanent witness really punctuates and nicely speaks to so much that a reader would know about the city. And I think the finer language of this poem and the other also places Adonis in conversation with the sorts of Arabic poetic conventions that he largely departs from. The grand questions like, have the holy books fallen into the abyss? Does anyone know Al-Quds except her stars? Call to poets like Darwish and Hafez. And even the scattering of those stars speaks to Hafez's Ghazal 5, where he says, Hafez keeps scattering the grain of your tears. Perhaps the bird of union will fly into our snare. And so it's, I think he does a beautiful job of articulating, like I said, those things that readers know about the city, but putting it in a new frame that's so touching and gentle and difficult.
Yeah. All right. So what's the next poem that you want to share with us?
So the next one is by Jackson Holbert. It's entitled Letter from 9 Mile. I think it's likewise stunning for completely different reasons. and I think it speaks to some of the variety that's in this edition in specific. I think the poem, and I'll read it in a moment, to use the journalistic phrase, buries the lead, where the central focus of it is obscured away from, but the ripples and reverberations of it are felt throughout in a really touching way. All right, Jackson Holbert, Letter from 9 Mile. Last night, coyotes yipped the dogs into a frenzy. Smoke and wind and toads croaking out their proud, weird songs. The Black River, the small stars. I've started to remember my dreams. It's night, March snow covers the hills. Last week, a boy named James dove into the river north of here. 4 miles down current, a farmer fished out his small, blue body. Outside my window, a crane breaks the last jigsaws of ice. Morning comes. It always does. The rabbits scurry down their narrow holes to live their underground lives. They pip up in the sun, then pip back down. I walk too long. It keeps the stars circling. I run my fingers along the tops of weeds. Every night, a dozen crows perch on the power lines and scream.
Oh, so much surprising and lovely and fun language in this poem.
Absolutely. And I think it's in such productive dissonance with the kind of dark and really difficult subject matter. And I think that the way in which the poem reflects on itself and has a beautiful symmetry across its parts is part of what really, really drew me to it. I think the formal choices beautifully fade into the background such that they just feel intimate and necessary in the poem, but are so integral to our understanding of it. I think Hobart writes last night as an opening,
yeah,
and then closing every night to have that same kind of disruptive sound. First the coyotes yipping the dogs into a frenzy, then the dozen crows perching on power lines screaming. I think sets it up for that symmetry that when you move closer to the center, you see the point from which all of that ripples, which is the boy, his blue body.
Oh, yeah.
Which is so difficult to digest. And I think the narrative distance that the poet evokes from that subject speaks to the gravity of it.
Yeah. Where is 9 Mile? Do you know?
I don't know. My only point of reference is 8 Mile.
Right.
I wouldn't do the disservice to assume that that's... All right. The third one that I chose is by Jessica Reed. It's entitled Space Without Objects. And it has an epigraph by George Musser. The epigraph reads, "Instead of thinking of space as an absolute necessity, we can regard it as one of the possible states of the universe, just as ice is one of the possible states of water. How near or far, how blunt the blow, like asking the address in arrow rain sheets of each drop, as in, where is it now? Proximity, a nightmare and a construct. You are your line in space-time. You are tenseless. All you have or will encounter. Green glass, trapped air, like asking icicles to persist in July, to point here. Your line seemed smaller. The epistemic circumstance of will I, when your future already exists. Extract space from causal events. Knock over a glass, unsteady, and the water is seeping. Its seeping wakes you, and you claw. This is a world line, grow into." And I think similar to the other selections for this podcast, it's just such a gentleness with language,
yeah,
that resonates so beautifully. And I think that gentle delivery is, just like the last one, a means to have a totally shattering premise in which one's choices are superfluous, in which there's this determinism present in the speaker, and that final idea of what a human being on a set course ought to feel when they're aware of that course, what one that is only a line in space-time does when they're aware of it. And that image of seeping, of those degrees of difference, is so, so profound.
I love that. I love your explanation almost as much as the poem, or just as much, really.
I've been reading a lot for finals week, and Jory Graham and Robert Haas, I think, do something similar, in which they come at something that's so metaphysical and profound and difficult to access, and situate that discovery in the poem in things that are banal, like a glass of water.
Yeah, those icicles in July. And
exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the beautiful things I think that poetry can do is take something that's otherwise utterly undigestible, mm-hmm, and make it worldly and accessible.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that one.
Yeah, me too. All right, the last one that I've selected for today, although any of these poems is worth reading, and going through them again over the last couple of days was absolutely a pleasure. The last one is Birds of New Jersey by Jess Williard. The problem with light is the emission of heat that follows, then burns, illuminates, then reduces. We can play the light against sheets, across walls, and sconce our way by lozenge lamps, but it is a kept kind of magic. a kind in which I'm barely interested. And yet, if we can't see something without burning it, who's to say where the terror ends? Here, I believe. Because the use of a thing that will die to be witnessed is just too close. We know too much. And the use of a thing that will flee as soon as it is seen is boundless. Osprey, plover, heron, lapwing, goldfinch. How I have tumbled so wholly.
I love the use of sconce as a verb.
I know. That's what struck me first when reading it.
Yeah.
How fantastic.
So surprising, but so... It's just wonderful description.
It's so fitting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the element of the poem that I am most touched by is the profound sense of longing by the speaker, and a desire to remain in a position from which the object of desire is always out of reach, that the birds flit away when first seen, and that by contrast, something that is wholly understood is too close to the viewer and therefore is destroyed by that understanding. That possibility is brought down and made worldly and real and therefore limited. And so I think the speaker's position of needing to be in that in-between zone in which the object is present but not in reach is, I think, really difficult ground to tread in a poem as brief as this.
Yeah. Do you think the same can be said of poetry?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That it's that always distant goal.
Yeah.
And the idea that kept magic, in contrast, is a kind in which I'm barely interested. It offers such like a banality, and it's really lovely.
Yeah. Oh, what a magical collection of poems. I love what you've curated here. I think that they tell a story in themselves that kind of speak to what's going on in this issue. And it was really fun to get to talk to you about them.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. As we wrap up, we're done with the fall semester pretty much. What's next on your reading list now that you have the time and space to kind of settle into something that you want to read?
As I put into definite terms, the coming break, the time and space is fleeting. And so I think for a forthcoming class in the spring, I'm going to wade in for the first time into Moby Dick.
All right.
Which I haven't done, shamefully. And so I'm looking forward to have the excuse to really sit down and do it. Yeah. For some of the finals that I've had this week, I revisited a lot of Don Revelle's work. And in doing so, discovered three or four books of poetry of his that I didn't know existed. And so I'm really looking forward to jumping into them more. And as I mentioned earlier, Robert Haas is a central influence, and I was reading a lot about him as well. And The Apple Trees at Alema, his new and collected, I didn't realize had so many new poems. And so I'm looking forward to getting my hand on a copy of that as well.
Cool. Well, Danny, thank you so much for joining me today. I hope that your break is lovely and restful and full of words. And podcast listeners will look forward to coming back to you in January.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Colorado Review podcast. Subscribe on iTunes or find us on the Colorado Review website, coloradoreview.colostate.edu. Also online, you can find selections from recent and archived issues of the journal, blog posts, reviews, and much more. This podcast is made possible by Colorado State University and the Center for Literary Publishing. Thanks for listening.